defend school districts against lawsuits and take on the legal representation of school districts who are sued by transgender students. And I think that's obviously a part of the national narrative, and it's encouraging this type of legislation. But more so even than the Alliance Defending Freedom is the reality that we live in a time where we continue to feel it appropriate to target and discriminate against the transgender community. And so we're all really complicit in a culture that tells trans women they're not real women, that tells trans men they're not real men. And that is the paradigm that allows this to happen.
Chase Strangio, I want to thank you for being with us, being back with us. He recently wrote a letter to the South Dakota lawmakers, which reads in part, quote, "If I were a student in South Dakota, chances are I would not survive into adulthood." We'll link to it at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Friday, February 19th, marks the 20th anniversary of Democracy Now!'s first broadcast. To celebrate with us, I hope you'll take a photo or a video, tell us who you are, where you tune in, why you need Democracy Now!, and post it online with the hashtag #HappyBirthdayDN. We'll feature your birthday message on the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 5 o'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The 5 o'clock news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Wamba at the Analog Cafe, Friday, February 19th at 10 p.m. Wamba is a Portland-based band that mixes traditional West African rhythms from Ghana with jazz, funk, and Afrobeat styles. Friday, February 19th, there will be a special two-set performance. The evening starts at 10 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence. That's taking place February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus in Portland. This year's keynote speaker will be Dana Bjarnason, the Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of OHSU. Topics covered by the conference include flight nursing, forensic nursing, veteran care, public health nursing, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence, taking place Saturday, February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus, 12000 Southwest 49th Avenue in Portland. The Oregon Student Nurses Association, working to lead the future of nursing. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council at this hour is discussing a new home for the Right to Dream 2 camp.
People of color are suffering from racial profiling at every point in the Multnomah County criminal justice system.
And an analysis released last week by the Sightline Institute near Seattle underscores chronic safety failures in the LNG industry.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 18th, 2016. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. At this hour, the Portland City Council is discussing the relocation of the Right to Dream 2 homeless camp from its current location in Old Town to an industrial area in southeast Portland. The council agreed to allow R2D2 to set up at Southeast 3rd Avenue and Harrison Street. This area is currently used for chemical deliveries to Eastside Plating. As long as the company could continue to receive shipments, this will remain in place. You can watch the City Council meeting live at www.portlandoregon.gov, and KBOO will have complete coverage on tomorrow's evening news.
Protesters gathered outside Governor Kate Brown's office and the Oregon House Gallery this morning to voice their grievances on the minimum wage bill. The minimum wage hike to them is slated far too distant a date and doesn't encompass other social and economic issues affecting working class and minority communities statewide. You've just heard sounds from just outside Oregon Governor Kate Brown's office. The protesters in Salem clamored for a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour by 2019 instead of 3 years later in 2022. Protesters also chanted Black Lives Matter and Restore Local Control, which expand the aims of the agitation to beyond just wage increases and improvements in working conditions. Plans to limit rent or other measures that address Oregon's housing crisis are not currently a part of Governor Brown's initiative to raise the minimum wage increase. Apparently, the agitation of the protesters had its desired effect on legislators gathered just inside the Oregon House, as Representative Peter Buckley was heard commenting on the protesters with, quote, change the tenor of the session before they were removed.
People of color are suffering from racial profiling at every point in the Multnomah County criminal justice system. Multnomah County stands out from 20 counties in the United States that have applied for and received a grant to study racial and ethnic disparity within their criminal justice system. Ours is the only county where the results of the newly released study are now in the public domain. By now, many Oregon residents in Portland, Gresham, and beyond have caught wind of the negative findings on Multnomah County's criminal justice system. The findings are that minorities, specifically African Americans, are unequally arrested, sentenced, and paroled, and disproportionately punished by the system at every turn. This news, however, doesn't come as a surprise to Native American, Hispanic, and Black communities in Multnomah County, who have been living for decades with the reality that the latest figures are now illustrating. KBOO's Joanne Hardesty on Voices from the Edge dove deep into the report this morning with Bobbin Singh from Oregon Justice Resource Center, who helped shed some more light and bring his perspective to the findings from this stirring report.
It's basically saying, again, that if you're Black, that more likely you're going to go to jail, you're going to go to prison, you're going to be referred to the DA, right. You're less likely to be diverted out of the system. And, you know, I think what sticks out for me is that this is system-wide. You know, there's disparities at the front end that come in with policing, but that what you see is that system stakeholders, like the district attorney's office, are sustaining those disparities and, in fact, in some instances, making them worse.
Right.
And then on the back end, when you have, you know, parole violations or the sheriff's department or DCJ involved, that you're seeing that Blacks are more likely to be popped for violations or, you know, those
types. They treat it more harshly when there is a violation.
Yeah. And what sticks out to me is that, you know, the seven unique decision-making points that the report identifies is that in each one of those decision-making points, there's a level of discretion that's right. involved, some subjectivity. And what we see through either explicit or implicit bias, you know, it's not necessarily that people are outward racist or things like that. But what we see is at those decision-making points is that there is some sort of discrimination happening, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's the most profound thing is that we have this level of discretion that exists at each one of these decision-making points, and it's not transparent necessarily. Right. There's not very much oversight. We're not understanding exactly how those decisions are being made. Right. But what we do understand is that when those decisions are being made,
right.
that the Black community in Portland is by far being treated far more severely. I think this report, if anything, is probably underreporting the yes. significance of the problem, especially when it comes to Native Americans and Hispanic, because mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we need to understand is how people are being identified
yes.
in this report, the
That's
demographics
right.
and how it's being collected. And a lot of times, most of the time, what you see is it's not self-identification,
right.
but identification by, you know, corrections or
right.
the police or, you know, the district attorney's office. And
right.
oftentimes if you know, look white, even though you may be of Hispanic background or Native American background, they're not counting you as such.
That's
and
right.
so I do think that we need to have the question about what to do next
right.
is we need to have this type of reporting regularly, in my opinion.
Annually, right.
Annually.
Yeah. Yes.
And that, you know, not only in Multnomah County, but I would argue in the five major counties here in mm-hmm. Oregon, at least as a start. I think, as you suggested earlier, if you're required to report and be transparent about this stuff, that helps reduce the disparities
yes.
in itself because you have to acknowledge that it exists.
That's
you're
right.
reporting on it, then you're conscious of it.
Right. And your bosses are actually expecting you to do something to eliminate the disparity,
mm-hmm.
right, as compared to what we have now.
Yeah.
Because at that point, every once a month, people had to be responsive to what are you doing to make that happen.
Yeah. I think another point that you made earlier is that, you know, the district attorney is an elected position here in Oregon.
Yes.
But we don't treat it as such. We don't treat any of the district attorneys, by and large, as elected positions. They're individuals who end up staying in office for a very long time, go unchallenged. Not very many people vote on the position. Mm-hmm. And the district attorney is the most, probably the most powerful person in our criminal justice system. And I think their professional membership organization, the Oregon District Attorney Association, is probably one of the most powerful groups when it comes to criminal justice reform at the state legislature.
Yes.
So one of the things that we can do is start paying attention to who our district attorney is, trying to understand what that individual is about, what their positions are on criminal justice issues, especially racial justice issues, mm-hmm. how they're engaging with communities of color. I think these are all really, really important things. And as a, just one thing that individuals can do is start voting and paying attention to what's going on with the district attorney's office.
You just heard co-founder of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, Bobin Singh, commenting on a new report regarding racial and ethnic disparity in Multnomah County's criminal justice system. This aired this morning on KBOO's current event show, Voices from the Edge, with Joanne Hardesty.
As many as 8 new pipelines, port facilities, and refineries will dot the landscape from Coos Bay, Oregon, to Anacortes, Washington. According to a report released by Sightline Institute, a think tank that promotes energy sustainability in the Pacific Northwest, the fracked fuel and petrochemical facilities analyzed by Sightline would pose serious challenges to local communities. These challenges would include the release of toxic contaminants in the air and water, an increase in carbon pollution, and facilities that would consume vast quantities of fresh water from the Columbia and other rivers. Sightline is concerned that these developments have been underreported in the media. The full report is entitled Fracked Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest and is available at sightline.org. Stay tuned to the end of tonight's broadcast when Sightline analyst Tarika Powell speaks about how the liquefied natural gas industry has cheated on its safety record.
A new bill passed in the Oregon House of Representatives will make it mandatory for companies like PGE and Pacific Power to generate 50% of their energy from renewable resources by the year 2040. House Bill 4036 includes a section eliminating coal-fired resources by the year 2030 and establishes community solar projects to allow consumers to purchase solar energy from a shared source. The bill also helps create a gradual transition to renewable resources over the next 30 years, with benchmarks every 5 to 10 years. Environmental groups and utility companies both support the bill because of environmental and economic growth expectations. A final clause in the bill addresses, quote, the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety. It does this by declaring the situation a state of emergency. The Oregon Senate will be next to look at the bill in the coming weeks.
Outdoor school is considered by many to be a rite of passage for 5th and 6th graders in the state of Oregon. The program brings kids out of their classroom and into old growth forests each spring. But the program is always underfunded. A new campaign called Outdoor School for All kicks off this Saturday to change that. Here live in the studio with us to talk about it is Benno Lyon, a teacher and parent. Benno, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Sarika. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, let's start out by just describing the program. What is Outdoor School?
Well, Outdoor School is a program that's been around for a long time in Oregon. We're one of the states that developed this program, so we're kind of a flagship in the nation. Here in Portland, it's 50 years old. We're celebrating our 50th year. And it's a residential outdoor education program. It's experiential. It allows for kids from different schools to get together in a camp environment for a week and to just really learn about water, soil, plants, animals, and natural resources, while also building community and experiencing a diverse, environment with other kids from around the city. So it's just a great program. It also involves high schoolers and leadership opportunities. So I love everything about it.
And within this program, kids are not just participants, but it is actually led in part by youths. Can you talk about the youth leadership aspect of Outdoor School?
Well, to me, that's one of the sort of hidden gems of Outdoor School. The fifth and sixth graders that get to go to Outdoor School is really the reason for the program. But one of the great things about Outdoor School as it's structured here is high schoolers volunteered for a week to lead the kids both in the cabins and out teaching on field study. So outdoor school changed my life. I went five times in high school for a week. So that's 5 weeks of my time in high school. And it led to me being a teacher ultimately. So, you know, I was asked to be a role model for these kids all week. I was asked to teach them about plants on field study. I was asked to lead campfires and, you know, speak and sing songs in front of 140 people. So my leadership and my speaking and my just confidence skills, all that's really where I learned to do so many of the things that I now do in my profession. So outdoor school taught me how to teach, and I thank it for that.
And why was outdoor school started? Who runs it?
Well, I don't know the whole story. There's a pretty famous guy named Mr. Gill, and he's still around. And he was one of the people who that was his camp name. And he helped start the program back in the 60s. It really just kind of came out of it was fairly organic that people in the area really thought it was important that kids sort of learn about the natural resources that make Oregon so special, and that they have an understanding of the sort of balance that we try to strike in terms of having a sustainable relationship with nature, but also that we use natural resources. And so they really believed that. I know it had some root in with I don't know if it was Girl Scouts or the Camps of America, but these people really got together and kind of got it going, and then it grew from there, and now it's become very much a part of what school districts do. I think I should go back and learn my history a little bit more on the original roots.
Interesting. But it was actually a good segue to my next question.
Can I say one thing though? But who runs it now? It's run now through the ESD districts. So you have like the Multnomah Educational Service District, for example, here in Multnomah County. You've also got Washington County. And the ESDs basically manage and run the program, and they have staff, and they hire all the camp staff. And then the school districts purchase the program as an option. It's an opt-in program. And so it's run through the ESDs, and then the schools can opt to participate.
Oh, that leads a little bit to what I was going to ask next, which is that not all school districts participate with the program. For example, Centennial School District doesn't participate at all. Why is it important for whole school districts that are not involved?
Well, I mean, every district has its own funding difficulties, and we know this. And so really it just comes down to decisions that are made about what programs can be supported and which ones can't. What I can say is outdoor school across the board is a really popular program. And any school district that feels that they really can afford it is certainly going to opt in to do it. It's, you know, the benefits are there. And even Portland, which was down to, you know, two nights a week for its students, this next year they've found somehow the funding to bring it back up to a 5-night week experience for the sixth graders, because it's that important to parents, it's that important to the students, and the district really hears that. So as far as the Centennial situation, I don't know exactly why they are not participating at this point in time. My guess is they would love to if they had the funding.
I see. Well, let's talk about the fundraiser. Your new campaign, Outdoor School for All, the campaign launch party is at the North Star Ballroom this Saturday. What are you gathering signatures to do?
Well, so we're doing our kickoff campaign, and this is a citizens initiative that we have that will fund outdoor school for all. And that literally means all kids in Oregon, every fifth or sixth grader, would have the opportunity to go to outdoor school for a full week, whether that's in rural Eastern Oregon or here in Metro Portland area or, you know, in Lane County. So all across the state, kids would get to go to outdoor school for a week. Historically, Oregon actually had a period of time where we had up to 80% of the kids in Oregon were going to outdoor school. Now we're at below 50%. But it's really kind of, it's a program that a lot of people who've grown up in Oregon are familiar with or went to. And if you ask them about it, they really have fond memories. So for us, the idea that we could get all kids going to outdoor school is great. And also, I really believe that the equity piece is really important. Some kids go, some kids don't. Some kids whose families can afford private camp experiences in the summer go to camp. And a lot of kids don't, and they never have that experience. So if we really, as a state, become the first state in the nation to say we're going to send every kid to an experiential outdoor education program, I think that's amazing.
So, Benno, speaking as a teacher, what do you think kids need in the schools today?
Well, that's a huge question. I would say they need outdoor school. I mean, they need to get outside. They need, you know, you'll read articles sometimes about nature deficit disorder and things like that. Kids need real hands-on experience. They need experiential education. They need to get outdoors. They need to get their feet dirty and pick things up and look at rocks and that kind of experience. I also think that in terms of the classroom, we need as much inquiry-based education as possible, project-based learning. You know, obviously, I'm a believer in less testing and more, you know, more projects and more inquiry and sort of pursuing the questions that really inspire you as a young thinker. How to get there, we could talk about that all day. But in terms of this particular program, I believe it's one piece of a puzzle that really can impact student lives.
What else do you see as the obstacles that outdoor school has faced over the years, and how will you overcome them with this new effort?
Well, this effort, this initiative would really in some ways be almost like a permanent solution for the funding problems that schools have faced in terms of bringing this program back to full life. What it would do is fund outdoor school via a mechanism in the lottery. And so it would become Oregon law that we would fund outdoor school. There's already a law on the books that has created a mechanism for having an outdoor school program. It just doesn't have funding attached to it. So this initiative, if we gather enough signatures to get it on the November ballot, would then go to the people to vote. And we're really optimistic about, because the program's so popular across the state, that people would pass this initiative. And so in a way, this would really just provide every school district funding to say, you now have the option to opt into an outdoor school program and the money's there for you. And I think most school districts will take that.
And for everyday people who do not have children, but who have just moved here to Oregon, how can they support this important program?
Well, sign the petition or sign up to go get signatures and volunteer for us. What the kickoff party is really about is trying to get volunteers who might want to gather signatures, but also just to come down and learn about the program. We have some guest speakers that are going to be great. We have high schoolers who are going to lead songs. And we really invite anybody to get involved. Timber Joey is going to be there speaking about his experience at outdoor school. Representatives from REI who are supporting this event will be there.
Well, we're running out of time, but we have just about a minute left. Is there anything more you want to tell us about outdoor school or the program on Saturday?
Well, if you want to know more about the program, please go to outdoorschoolforall.com. I would like to share just one or two quotes from students.
Okay.
And I'll end with that. These are things that my students wrote. It was inspiring to see how all the student leaders were so into the activities. Their enthusiasm was amazing. It was easier to be super involved in the crazy songs and to learn things in field study when everyone was so alert and so ready. It helped me. I was hesitant and skeptical at first, but I actually had so much fun at camp. And one last quote, because this gets at, I think, the diversity that gets built at outdoor school. As the days went on, more and more conversations sprouted between soon-to-be friends I felt at home with. Within this cabin, we connected in ways most of the time only found between brothers. Yes, maybe some of the people there were not my best friends, but I felt as though we all learned to like each other because of the way we were able to make a cabin where no one was excluded and no tight cliques could be formed. So outdoor school builds peace, it builds community, it gets kids outside. Please join us in this campaign.
Thank you so much, Benno. That was Benno Lyon speaking for the Outdoor School for All campaign. To find out more about their project, you can go online, www.outdoorschoolforall.org. Their campaign kickoff is Saturday, February 20th at 2 p.m. at the North Star Ballroom, 635 North Killingsworth Court.
In Wisconsin today, Latino immigrants, workers, students, immigration activists, and civil rights activists all left school and walked off their jobs to march on the Wisconsin Capitol building. They are protesting the recent passage of two bills by the state legislature deemed racist and anti-immigrant. One of the bills would prohibit county governments from issuing identification cards to undocumented workers, and the other would put limits on the ability of so-called sanctuary cities to prohibit public employees, such as police officers, from inquiring about the immigration status of individuals. Activists say this would allow for more indiscriminate arrests of immigrants for deportation in these areas. The crowd of demonstrators that that flooded the Capitol building and the surrounding area was estimated at about 14,000 people, this according to Madison police. The demonstrators argue that even if these bills, which Governor Scott Walker seems likely to sign, even if they do pass, the protest will still prove to Wisconsin how much the state depends on the hard labor of immigrants. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Mario Ramirez, an organizer with Voces de la Frontera.
Yeah, my name is Mario Ramirez. I'm an organizer in a community-based organization, Voces de la Frontera.
Could you tell me a little bit about the two bills that are moving through the Wisconsin legislature right now?
Yeah, it's AB 450 and SB 533, two anti-immigrant law proposals. So it really affects the Dani community. In Wisconsin, we don't, long time ago, they denied driver license for many people. And that's really affects people to move for work or take kids to school, to go to the hospital. Well, it's really, really bad. But that kind of law proposal is they given the right to the police officers to ask for immigration status of to the people who doesn't have any identification. This if this law passed, people will be afraid to report crimes to the police because they know the police officers will be asking for immigration status. The thing is, many people are going to take advantage of the others. The other is SB 533 in Milwaukee County. The Milwaukee County IDs in last year, and we was trying to test in Madison too, but now with this SB 533, they prohibit to the counties give ID to the people. So it's really an anti-immigrant law. People today get they are tired. They are really disappointed about this kind of racist law proposal. Not only the workers, it's the employers too. A lot of employers they are really mad about today because a lot of workers need to work. And like in the dairy farmers, they really care about people not show up to work today, and they know a lot of people will be marching today. So it's not affect only the workers, affect employers, affect the economy.
So a lot of workers staged a walkout or a strike. A lot of workers did not go to work today. And do you think the employers, the businesses who employ the workers, are they sympathetic to the plight of their immigrant workers, or would they rather this type of thing not happen at all?
I heard a lot of things where they say they really support the workers because they need them. One of those, the manager, he said, well, I didn't know what's really going on with the workers. In the beginning, I was really angry about they needing to work for one day, affect my business, affect my customers, and it's really bad. But now I understand this because they are fighting to protect their families, to work a work in peace. The government is pushing the workers to do that. So when he understood, when I told him that, he understand, and he said he will be happy to sign a petition or send a letter to the governor.
So you understand the problem to be that these two new laws that are being proposed will threaten immigrant workers' security and their ability to contribute, essentially, to the Wisconsin economy. And so once business owners understand that their own economic situation is threatened by the bills, you think that the business owners will be sympathetic to your cause?
They understand, like I told them, people are not really happy to miss work today because they have to pay bills. The workers really suffer because it's a one day no pay.
Yeah.
So, but definitely the workers really, if they doing this, it's because they are really scared about the situation.
That was Mario Ramirez, an organizer for Voces de la Frontera. And this is Ethan Martin at KBOO.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with the in-depth news team. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Portland area's Black African community. Tomorrow's weather will be wet, with highs in the low 50s and lows in the upper 30s, and rain all day long. Today in history, in 1983, 13 people were murdered during a robbery at the Wami Club in Seattle's Chinatown, the worst mass killing in Washington state history, and the worst robbery-motivated mass murder in U.S. history. In 1970, the Chicago Seven were acquitted on charges of inciting riots during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. An eighth defendant, Black Panther leader Bobby Seale, had his trial cut short and was later sentenced separately to 4 years in prison for contempt of court. Also, today marks the 131st anniversary of the publication of Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, from which we get our quote today, and I will turn it to Robert.
I was a-trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right, then I'll go to hell. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, is gearing up for this year's FOILES, the FOI standing for Freedom of Information. This is their dubious awards ceremony recognizing the most inappropriate, silly, or evasive official responses to Freedom of Information Act and state public record requests. Submissions are due on Saturday, February 20th. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Dave Moss at the EFF about the purpose of the awards and what they say about the state of government transparency in the year 2016.
Okay. I'm talking with Dave Moss. He is an investigative researcher with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we're going to talk about an awards ceremony being planned for Sunshine Week in March called the FOILES. Can you explain how it began and how it works?
This will be the second year that we've done the FOILES. The idea is to recognize all of the weird, wacky, aggravating, frustrating, and darn right nefarious ways that government agencies respond to public records requests or Freedom of Information Act requests. So that ranges from asking for excessive fees, ridiculous redactions, times where public officials have attempted to retaliate against people who file FOIA requests, the whole range of things. Last year, we were totally surprised by some of the things that were sent our way, and we're hoping to have a similar batch of absurd opacity by the government coming up for Sunshine Week.
Has your organization made any modifications as a result of what you learned from launching this process last year?
we maybe adjusted the parameters a little bit to be a bit more inclusive and to make it a little bit easier to submit. To tell you the truth, you know, this is a tongue-in-cheek awards. We don't have very strict requirements. We collect all the things we can, and we try to give out as many awards as we can. So it's still out there. It's pretty open. The rules haven't changed all that much. Something in the public records request process had to have happened in 2015. That's basically it. And half of the stuff tends to come from the public. Half of it tends to come from us digging through stories that we've seen, going through the hashtag FOIA Friday Twitter threads, looking for stuff that we can identify. This isn't a scientific award because we give out so many of them, and we usually come up with funny names for each of them as well.
Can you give our listeners an example?
Well, last year I think we had an award for the most mysterious mystery meat, because there was a school district that, when asked through a public records request to tell what its ingredients were in its lunch meats, it came back saying that chicken nuggets included chicken, and that was all that they said. And it was things like that, and it took a lot of pressure for the reporter who had filed the request to actually get the real ingredients. So that would be an example of one of the fun ones. I can't tell you what we're going to be doing this year, but I do have some ideas. I think you can expect us to deal with the issue of public officials who use private email servers to store government emails and protect those emails from FOIA requests. That is something we'll probably deal with, and you can maybe guess who we'll be highlighting with that.
Do you anticipate any repeat winners?
Oh, possibly. I think we gave Governor Martinez of New Mexico an award last year, and I think that might come up again. Like I said, we haven't figured things out, but you know, there are repeat offenders. The NYPD tends to have a lot of issues that come up year after year after year. So they're definitely on our long list at this point. But we'll see. We'll dig through it, and part of the process isn't just identifying it. We do try to do a little bit of fact-checking. We like to call up the person who filed the public records request to get a little bit more background. Sometimes things get nominated, and it turns out they weren't really as big a deal as you thought. For example, there was one request that came our way, and I think it was somebody had filed a request for records from a courthouse, and they were given a $17 million fee estimate. And we were like, woohoo, that is going to get a FOIA this year. But as it turned out, when we called the reporter, that seemed to be a typo error from the agency. We had to kind of double back on that one, unfortunately, although we are still trying to figure out which one last year did get the highest fee estimate. There was a fee estimate of over $1 million last year for the FOILEs related to El Chapo's investigative files from, I believe it was from DHS or the DEA, one of the two. We're hoping to top that this year, but I'm not sure that's going to be the case.
Any award winners from last year make an effort to improve on their performance as it pertains to responding to FOIA requests?
Ooh, well, we would hope so. I don't have any direct evidence of it. But what I can tell you is that the FOILEs were cited in the House Oversight Committee's report on the broken FOIA system. So that was quite a victory.
I've been talking with Dave Moss. He's the investigative researcher with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more information, you can visit their website at eff.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
A court order requiring Apple to give the FBI access to encrypted cell phone data in conjunction with the San Bernardino couple who killed 14 people has cybersecurity experts concerned. In an open letter, Apple CEO Tim Cook stated he would fight the directive. He likened it to the U.S. government asking Apple to, quote, build a backdoor to the iPhone, and emphasized that though the government request is limited, quote, there is no way to guarantee such control. Tech insiders and security advocates fear a precedent will be set for the FBI to access the contents of any device, in essence, weakening or nullifying their encryption capabilities. ACLU staff attorney Alex Abdo issued a statement about the dangers of the case, that could set, saying, quote, if the FBI can force Apple to hack into its customers' devices, then so too can every repressive regime in the rest of the world. According to an anonymous source familiar with the matter, Apple will file an opposition to the ruling.
Should high school students be required to answer questions about their disciplinary history on college applications? On Thursday, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law called for the removal of discipline questions. The common application completed by 860,000 students last year was used by more than 620 colleges and universities. These discipline questions were added in the year 2006. A report last year found that 89% of higher education institutions use disciplinary information from high school as a factor in the admission process. Advocates for removal of the questions are concerned that youthful mistakes can haunt students throughout their careers. This is especially true for minority students who are suspended and arrested at disproportionately higher rates than their white peers. Kristen Clark, the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee Advocacy Group, said, "So long as racial disparities persist at every stage of our criminal justice system, we fully expect that these kinds of questions will unfairly deny educational opportunity to or have a chilling effect on African Americans and other minority groups."
Crews working for Southern California Gas have intercepted a faulty well in Aliso Canyon, stopping a three-month natural gas leak that has driven thousands of L.A. County residents from their homes. For the California Report, Molly Peterson has more.
Before Christmas, the company began drilling down to plug the well after six attempts at the surface failed. SoCalGas spokeswoman Stephanie Donovan says the relief well had to catch its target a mile and a half underground.
Imagine if you were trying to thread a needle at the end of a football field in the dark, what a complex, challenging operation that would be.
Donovan says next, SoCalGas will cement the well. Oil and gas regulators will inspect it to say it's shut down for good. People from L.A.'s Porter Ranch neighborhood who left, many complaining of health problems, then have 8 days to return. But Los Angeles City Councilman Mitchell Englander says his constituents need assurances to do so.
The next several phases are critical. So this is just yet a beginning of a new process.
Also still ahead, multiple investigations into the cause of the leak and its consequences. An estimated 95,000 tons of methane came out of the broken well over the last several months. Environmentalists think that will have the same climate impact over the next 20 years as burning a billion gallons of gasoline. For the California Report, I'm Molly Peterson in Los Angeles.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan claims to have found evidence linking two Kurdish groups to Wednesday's bombing in the Turkish capital of Ankara. 28 people were killed, many of them military personnel, and over 60 people were injured in the bombing, which happened near a cluster of government buildings. The groups blamed by Erdogan are the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK, and the Syrian Kurdish People's Protection Units, known as the YPG. Turkey has long considered both of these groups to be terrorist organizations. The PKK have been active in the fight for Kurdish independence in southeastern Turkey, also known as North Kurdistan, since the year 1984. The YPG, by contrast, was founded in the year 2004 after a Syrian government crackdown on Kurdish dissidents. It has been the primary military force on the ground in the Kurdish theater of the Syrian civil war. Also, the YPG is an ally of the United States. A second attack occurred on Thursday following the Ankara attacks in a province in southeast Turkey. Six Kurdish soldiers were killed in this car bombing, which also was blamed on the PKK. Turkey has been fighting both of these groups within Syria and within Iraq, carrying out multiple airstrikes for the last several months.
Austria is facing backlash from the EU after a decision to cap the number of people who can apply for asylum per day. Austrian Chancellor Werner Faymann brushed off the criticism from the EU, despite the fact that the plan is seen as unlawful. The plan would limit asylum applications to 80 per day. Though Austria would still allow 3,200 people to enter per day if they were continuing on to a neighboring country, such as Germany or Sweden. Austria has already increased border security, adding identity checks at border crossing points and coordinating with other European nations to prevent refugees from entering from Greece. Austria's decision this week to limit applications comes after a request for 600 million euros from the EU to help cover so-called unbudgeted costs, such as housing and care for asylum seekers. Earlier this month, Chancellor Faymann asked the EU's border agency, Frontex, to consider sending Greece-bound refugees back to Turkey. The EU has struggled to find a unified policy to manage the refugee situation, and that will be one topic of discussion during an upcoming EU summit in Brussels.
Yeah.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad, Jeff Henderson, Ethan Martin, Robin Ryan, and Kanan Schlesinger. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Pat Epstein. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sari Gametha.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, Ani and Lynn will speak with Barbara Ford and David Solnit, both arts workers with 350.org, about melding art and activism. At 9, on the Veterans Voice Radio Show, Marvin and Angie celebrate 25 years on KBOO Community Radio. And at 10, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis speaks about the two Dr. Martin Luther Kings, the mythical man, and the real human being. Thank you to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one easily by going to